From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Full snow moon tonight. It is absolutely breathtaking. If you get a chance to look, go peek. Later tonight, star seeds. Here's what's happening. Tragedy in the Swiss Alps. About a dozen people may have been buried following an avalanche at a very popular Swiss Alps ski resort. Rescuers were searching for people with the aid of dogs and helicopters. So far, no luck. President Donald Trump has expressed confidence that he would prevail in a lawsuit filed by 16 states seeking to overturn his declaration of a national emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border, saying the states are led by mostly by open-border Democrats and the radical left. First, let's check in with John Curtis, Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, first of all, do you think the president has a right to say this is an emergency?
Well, it, you know, depends on what your definition of emergency. I think, you know, does it have to do with, you know, a tsunami hitting the West Coast or, you know, some kind of a major earthquake? No, it's not that type of an emergency. But it is a crisis on the border. Trump has Article 2 power, being president of the United States and commander-in-chief. And, George, really what, you know, the Democrats have done with this, and, you know, the state's attorneys general that are largely Democrat, Trump is right about that, is that they've made this kind of a turf war, a kind of constitutional crisis. The truth of the matter is that the executive branch and the legislative branch each have their own power and authority, and there are purse strings that are controlled not by the Congress. I mean, contrary to what you hear, if you listen to some of the pundits on these news shows that are anti-Trump and, you know, clearly saying that there's some kind of a fascist constitutional crisis happening, it's preposterous. The executive branch is capable of starting wars, funding wars, for whatever reason, spending trillions of dollars on these wars, not a measly few billion to build out a border wall, and they don't require congressional approval at all for that. So what you have right now are Democrats posturing before an election year, talking about this as some kind of a constitutional crisis, when the executive branch and the legislative branch are always in competition for making, you know, these decisions about the purse strings and priorities where money can be spent. And I think under Article 1, you know, the Congress has its authority, and I don't believe that Trump is trying to usurp their authority. I think what he's trying to do is say, look, we have a border emergency, in his estimation and the estimation of a number of other attorneys that are working for him, and they're saying, You don't have to politically agree with me about it, but I'm entitled as commander-in-chief to recognize that the flood of drugs and human trafficking going on the southern border is a serious problem to the United States, and that he will take charge with his executive Article 2 powers as commander-in-chief and allocate the resources needed for that. Now, if that has to go to a court battle, sure, the Democrats might be able to find a district court somewhere that will agree with them, or even a circuit court. But if this thing continues to go on, just like that travel ban for individuals immigrating from Muslim countries, you know, Trump could very well prevail in the Supreme Court on this. He's got a 5-4 majority of conservatives right now.
All right, thank you, John. John's website, onlinecolumnist.com. And, of course, the liberal Howard Bloom. What do you think, Howard?
I couldn't disagree more with John. I mean, I disagree radically.
Well, you two never agree on anything anyway, right?
That's right. But, okay, so here's where the battle of the emergency stands. Donald Trump has declared a national emergency so he can get together the $6 billion he wants for a first installment of his wall. Now, why is this $6 billion worth of wall just a mere installment? Because America's border with Mexico is 2,000 miles long. That's roughly the distance from L.A. to Chicago. Now, imagine what it would cost to build a big, beautiful wall from L.A. to the city of the Chicago Cubs. So President Trump's figures for a full wall have been in the $25 billion range, and that may be a gross underestimate. Meanwhile, it turns out that a national emergency is not unusual. 53 national emergencies have been declared since 1976. 32 of these national emergencies are still in effect. Now, what is unusual, and this is something where John and I really disagree, is using a national emergency to override Congress and to yank money from budgets that Congress has allocated for other purposes. Military officials, according to the Military Times, have deemed the projects from which the president is planning to steal some of his funds critical to force readiness. That means critical to your security and mine. More important, the Constitution does say that only Congress has the power of the purse. Now, some argue that what President Trump is doing is unconstitutional. John is right about that. They say that he is grabbing hold of a power that the Constitution gives to Congress and only to Congress. Trump's opponents also accuse him of manufacturing a fake crisis. Immigration across the Mexican border, they say, has gone down dramatically in the last 12 years, and that's true. What's more, once immigrants get here, numerous studies show that they are less violent and criminal than the Americans who are so anxious to lock them out. Trump says that those who come across the border are rapists, murderers, and drug dealers and gang members. Say Trump's critics, these claims are false. Now, even Fox News' Brit Hume confessed to Tucker Carlson that, quote, what we're getting is families and small children, and it used to be that we got, you know, single men. The crisis, says Hume, is that these women and children have overwhelmed our officials at the border, and that, says Hume, has created a crisis. Yes, a noted Fox commentator says the crisis is not one of rapists, murderers, drug dealers, and gang members. It's a crisis of women and children. Fox News has also featured Border Patrol wives to bolster the case for the wall. Alas, the Border Patrol wives said that they live in the Rio Grande Valley, where the rapists, murderers, drug dealers, and gang members should be streaming through like a flash flood, and yet these wives told Fox they feel perfectly safe. It's just that they feel their husbands could use a little extra help in high-traffic areas. Meanwhile, Tucker Carlson said that the evidence that immigrants are more peaceful than folks born and raised in America doesn't exist. Sorry, Tucker, I have seen the research. I've worked with it. It might be time to educate yourself. The last word goes to George Washington, who disagreed with Donald Trump profoundly about those seeking asylum in the United States. Our first president and founding father, yes, I'm talking George Washington himself, said, may America be an asylum to the persecuted of the earth.
Interesting take, Howard. Does the president or the states win these lawsuits?
Well, I'm hoping that the states win because John said that the president is commander in chief. Has a whole bunch of powers, including the power to make war. No, that's unconstitutional. Ever since the Vietnam War, our presidents have been getting, and even Harry Truman, with the Korean War, our presidents have been taking us into wars. But that is against the Constitution. The Constitution says that Congress has to be consulted and has to agree to make a war.
That's true. Howard Bloom, thank you so much. How would you like to work a four-day work week and still get paid for five?
Hey,
everybody would, huh? The founder of one of the first big companies in New Zealand has switched to a four-day working week, kept the money the same for everybody, and apparently he says they've resulted in a 20% rise in productivity, and everybody seems happy and profits have increased. Interesting take there. Ford Motor Company said it will close its oldest factory in Brazil and exit its heavy commercial truck business in South America, a move that'll cost more than 2,700 jobs there as part of restructuring meant to end losses around the world. As we've been reporting, Payless Shoes has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and will close all of its North American stores. They've even upped it to 2,500 stores from the 2,100 it cited on Friday. What's causing all of this? Let's check in with registered investment advisor, Mitch Shedlock. Michael, what is it, the Internet? What's happening to Payless?
Hey, well, George, you know and I know we've talked about this before. It's Amazon. First off, I want to congratulate you for presenting both sides of the story so the listening audience can hear what's really going on with the wall. They can take their case. George, that's why we follow you, because that's what you do. In regards to Payless, we saw this coming. Amazon is out there. You know, it's just taking, you know, all kinds of traffic from all these
retailers. Yep.
Is that a bad thing, though, George? They're offering free delivery, you know, free returns. I happen to think that is a good thing. People are free to disagree with me. Meanwhile, today, Citigroup came out. I don't know if you saw this one. they are going to cut 20,000 people. They said they hinted this last year, but today they confirmed it. They're going to cut 20,000 people, you know, from online answering, and they're going to go to automated services. George, I don't know about you. I can't stand when I have to go through five levels of menu just to get to talking to somebody. But this is what's going on. Meanwhile, George, we talked about retail sales the last time I was on. They have plunged. Industrial production is falling, collapsing throughout the entire world. Meanwhile, I looked at the bond report. I'm going to have something out there on the internet. I'll send your producer a link.
Okay.
I don't have it posted yet, but the yield curve is signaling a recession, George. We've talked about this before. The seven-year interest rate bond has a lower yield than the one-year interest rate bond. We have had an inverted yield curve. That is the big signal for recession. For the last 2 months, consistently, portions of the yield curve have been inverted, George.
Mish, back to Payless for a second. I didn't think people would buy shoes online. I thought they'd like to go to the store, try them on, and then pick them.
Ah, but what if you get free returns, George? That's what I would have thought, too. These companies are promising free returns. I've done it many times myself off of Amazon. This is what they're competing with, George. What do you think? Free returns?
Interesting take. Mish, thank you so much. I'm going to ask you, Gina, in the little booth there, just wave your head. As a lady, would you buy shoes online or would you go to the store? You would not buy them online. That's an interesting take. Karl Lagerfeld, one of the most prolific and widely popular designers of the 20th and 21st centuries, has died in Paris. He was 85, creative director for Chanel. While a woman from Oxford, England, has become the first person in the world to have had gene therapy to try to halt the most common form of blindness in the world, macular degeneration, the surgeons injected a synthetic gene in the back of her eye in a bid to prevent more cells from dying. Let's see if that works. I hope it does. The known universe just got a lot bigger. A new map of the night sky charts hundreds of thousands of previously unknown galaxies with millions of stars in each galaxy, discovered using a telescope that can detect light sources that optical instruments cannot see. And I bet there are some more lives out there on those other planets somewhere. It's amazing. Up next, mounds, mysterious mounds found all over North America. Lynn Marzulli, LA is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, one of our favorite guys, Lynn L.A. Marzulli with us. L.A. is an author, lecturer, filmmaker. He has penned many books, including the Nephilim Trilogy, received an honorary doctorate for the series from the Pacific International University. L.A. has lectured on the subjects of UFOs, the Nephilim, ancient prophetic texts, presenting his research at conferences and churches, and appearances and interviews on media outlets worldwide, DVD series as well. L.A., welcome back. And I've got to ask you, how are things since the California fire? Because I know you lost your house and a lot of other things with it.
First of all, George, thanks for having me on. Always good to be on Coast. And, we relocated to Oklahoma. Go figure.
How'd you end up there?
The last thing we got really good friends here. Gary Stearman, Bob Ulrich.
Okay.
Other people are here.
They're helping you out. Good.
10 years. Yeah. So it's, we bought a home here and we're settled in, and I'm back in the edit booth, and we're working hard.
I don't want to get too personal, but I guess did insurance help you out there?
It did. And also a lot of people donated, which was just absolutely overwhelming. I mean, some churches donated upwards of, tens of thousands of dollars to help us out. And that's why we're in this house, and we're about 100 days since the devastating fire, which, by the way, took everything, all of our inventory. Wow. I mean, absolutely everything. We wound up with a few cameras, some computers, and two suitcases.
But you're still in business, right?
Yeah, we're back up and running again. We're actually shipping out this week for the first time.
Good for you.
Shipping Ellie. Product.
Good for you. Well, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the mound builders. And I've got to tell you, in my days in St. Louis, I would go over to Cahokia every once in a while and see the Cahokia mounds. Yeah. Very fascinating. But tell me about the mound builders and in your opinion of all these things.
Let's start at Cahokia, the site. I filmed at the site. First of all, the plaza is 45 acres, and it's pretty much dead level. When I say that, it's level within 2 inches. You can do this in modernity because you've got earth movers and dozers and transits, and now we've got lasers and GPS yep. coordinates. But you look back 3,000 years or 2,000 years, and it begs the question, how did they level a 45-acre plaza? More so, the mound of Cahokia is the largest earthen mound in North America, upwards of, I would say, definitely over 500,000 tons. To give you an idea what that looks like.
That's a lot of dirt.
Tons of it. It's a lot of dirt. It's basically you would take dump trucks, fill them with dirt, and you'd have about 250 miles back-to-back of dump trucks. That's what it would take to build Cahokia. And it's like we're supposed to believe that Native Americans took these flint hoes or the scapula of a deer and went out and dug the dirt basket by basket and hauled it. And it took earlier archaeologists said, well, it must have taken 200 years. But now they opened up the mound fairly recently in the last 20 years. And they wait a minute, you know, this thing was built in about 20 years. So that changes the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And what that amounts to, 500,000, let's just round it off to 500,000. That's about 30 million single buckets of earth weighing about 30 pounds each. We actually hired a flint napper, George, a guy that created museum pieces. And so he made us a replica of a hoe that was allegedly used, to build Cahokia and all these other mounds all over the United States. So we hired a flint laborer. We went out with our cameras and we watched this guy dig. And we timed it to see how long it would take to dig, let's say, 30 pounds of dirt, has to gather it up in his hands, put it in some sort of a container, and then truck it to the site. We've never even touched on the compaction of the dirt and the shaping of the dirt. This is extremely, and we brought in Chief Joseph Riverwind, who's a First Nation peace chief. And we asked him, Chief, you know, what's the deal here? Why is it that Native Americans remember killing the giants but don't remember building the mounds? And he looked at me, and on camera, he basically says, because we didn't build them. We built some replicas that were much smaller, but we didn't do this. These were here before we got.
If they didn't build them, L.A., if they didn't build them, who did?
Nephilim. The giants. And this is the first in a series, George. It's called On the Trail of the Nephilim. I'm actually working on the second film. It'll be out in March. It's an ambitious schedule. I'm trying to turn out 4 one-hour films a year because this stuff is everywhere. We went out shooting last summer, and we've got hours and hours and hours of film. And I am just, you know, floating off the ground. I'm so excited about the new series because there is a hidden history, as Scotty Walter would say. There is a hidden hit under our noses. You know, he used to go out and look at Cahokia. And the whole thing has been managed by people who embrace a particular paradigm. And actually, in the film, we drill down into the academic bias that is there. We bring on a guy. You can't make this stuff up. There was a guy, let me tell you the story real quick. There was a microscopist, and his name is Mark Armitage, and he was at a prominent university in Southern California. So he goes out to Hell's Creek one year, and he's looking for dinosaur fossils, and he finds a large Triceratops horn, brings it back to his lab as a microscopist, opens the thing up, lo and behold, he finds soft tissue in the Triceratops horn, which we all know that can't possibly be. If the thing is like millions and millions of years old, there's no way soft tissue. So the guy's he's a Christian guy, and the department knows that. But he writes a paper which is published in a secular journal. He doesn't bandwagon him with the Bible or anything else. Doesn't do that. He just publishes what he finds. This is what I found. Here are the pictures. You know, you tell me what I'm looking at. Come and give me a peer review. Look at the research. Whatever. He's fired from his job because of a secular journal where he publishes his findings. He's fired. He takes the thing to court. He wins out of court. They settle out of court. There is an academic bias. I've run up against it.
Yes.
When I've talked to archaeologists, when I've talked to docents at these sites, They have a paradigm. They guard the paradigm, no matter how ridiculous it is. George, when I show what 25 million buckets of earth look like to an audience, the audience just sits there and howls with laughter.
Absolutely. L.A., stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Plus, we'll talk about the Nephilim. Of course, it's from the Bible. And the Bible simply said they were the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men. I'll have you explain that when we come back. Well, I'll meet you downtown in Columbus, Ohio on May 11th at the Lincoln Theater because we are going to have our live show there, and we're really looking forward to it. It is more than halfway sold out already, and those tickets will go quickly, so don't get left out. Simply go to events at coasttocoastam.com. And click it there or in the carousel reel at coasttocoastam.com, or you can call their ticket center in Columbus, Ohio at the Lincoln Theater, 614-469-0939. That's 614-469-0939. Then on July 27th, we're going to Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Miramar area at the Miramar Cultural Center for a live stage show, including one of the many guests will be Hunter Billy Carson. I'm looking forward to talking with Billy again. Live band there, too, and a meet and greet. Events at coasttocoastam.com to get those tickets or call the Ticketmaster at 1-800-745-3000. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. L.A. Marzulli with us. L.A., let's talk a little bit about the Nephilim, of course, the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of Earth. Now, who were the sons of God?
Well, this is a question which has created great controversy for thousands of years.
Sure.
But in my opinion, the sons of God are the fallen angels. And this all hails back to Genesis 3:15, which is, when I use that, that's just the first book in the Bible. It's the beginning. So it's just an address that you can go to and read it for yourself. And basically it says that the seed of a serpent will be at enmity with the seed of the woman. Someone from the seed of the woman, will crush the head of the serpent, and the serpent will strike his heel. It's a prophecy which is thousands of years old. We know that the seed of the woman culminates, and the fruition of that is in the birth of Messiah, which Christians believe happened 2,000 years ago, roughly. But the seed of the serpent erupts three chapters later. And if you were going to keep something really from the people of the world, this is what you would keep from them, because this outlines, literally, in my opinion, the rest of the biblical prophetic narrative. And this is what has been kept really apart from most of the people on the planet. I mean, and I'm not overstating this. The Book of Enoch, which is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, quoted 70 times in the Tanakh, the Old Testament, and also referred to in the New Testament, talks about and amplifies this unholy union of the sons of God, these fallen angelic entities. They're doing it because they rule the planet, and they don't want to give it up. And they know that if they can somehow stop this entity, this someone who's coming, Messiah, who will crush the head of the serpent, if they can do that, then they'll win. That's what's at stake here. I'm actually working on yet another book about this, about the multiple incursions and how this has created, again, a lot of controversy. Some people believe that after the flood, the Nephilim didn't return or they came through the line of Ham. And the new book will talk about that, but I digress. But that briefly is what they are. And what's amazing about this, George, the remnants, the trail of the Nephilim is global. There's a fingerprint of the supernatural of these entities are everywhere.
They may have built the pyramids.
Well, that's another question. Let me ask you this. There are, I think, either three or four. They're very large stones, the size of railroad cars. They're granite. They come from Aswan, 500 miles away. These stones line the roof of the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid. You cannot cut granite in the Neolithic, 3,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago, when the pyramid was allegedly built. You can't cut granite with copper chisels. And how did they move them from Aswan, 500 miles away? Never mind the math and everything else that is embedded in the pyramid, because it's eight-sided, not four, because of the concave. But anyway, but those granite blocks, just focus in on those, Zaliyawas, You tell me, show me how it was done. And that's why, and getting back to the mound builders, that's the archaeologist said that Native Americans did this with primitive tools. So we hired a flint knapper, and he went out there and he dug, and we showed on film what this is like, 25 million single buckets. And the whole theory begins to collapse when you drill in.
Oh my God.
Drill in on it,
yep.
In my opinion.
It sure does. You have sent Lex a picture of a six-fingered skeleton photo. We've got it up in the first spot at the carousel reel at coasttocoastam.com. Tell us a little bit about this.
It's in the film, and the reason why I put it in the film, it was found on Catalina Island, and I had access to the archives from the Ralph Glidden archives. Glidden was a primitive archaeologist who's been, you know, maligned by mainstream archaeologists today, a little more than a grave robber. Okay, I get it. And I'm not trying to defend Ralph Glidden, but what I was interested in was the cache of records, because it comes from 1921, when he was employed by the Hay Museum. The Hay was later gobbled up by the Smithsonian. So it's a treasure trove of information, and I got access to that, and I found photographs which were unbelievable. That is a six-fingered skeleton. You can count the fingers for yourself, and you can see that the thumb is just a little bit away from the hand, but those are all long fingers. There's no thumb that is shown there, but the thumb has been detached. That skeleton, by the way, is just under 9 feet or around 9 feet long. We had several people analyze that skeleton.
Goliath.
Based on the artifact in front of it, it's about 9 feet. The reason why it's there is because Native American people from Maine to California talk about red-haired, six-fingered, cannibalistic giants that they had to fight.
Now,
they had to fight.
Let me ask you this about the Nephilim. If they were the offspring of fallen angels, who weren't the chosen ones by any means, does that mean they've been seeded with some kind of evil, the Nephilim?
The Nephilim, in my opinion, are in a fixed state, absolutely in a fixed state. And I believe that they are irredeemable because, first of all, they have no soul. They're in a fixed state, and they have no soul. What's interesting, there's another prophetic scripture which talks about this. This happens thousands of years, written thousands of years after the Genesis narrative. But it talks about that in the later days, very enigmatic scripture, very cryptic. It says, in the latter days, their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to them. What the heck is that?
Yeah.
It can't be the seed of men mingling with the seed of men. That makes no sense. And what we're looking at, again, is the mischief of the fallen angels, as my friend the late Chuck Messer would say. And it goes back to the Genesis 6 narrative. This is why the Genesis 3:15 scripture is so imperative for us to come to grips to. And this sets up the rest of the deal into modernity. It dovetails into our work with the abduction phenomena that we did with the late Dr. Roger Lehr, the implants, the hybrid, which we show in one of our films. This is ongoing, George. This is ongoing. Hybrids are real. David Jacob would back me up on that 100%. They are real. There's a breeding program going on. And what's amazing about it, all of this is spelled out loud and clear in the biblical prophetic narrative.
Does that mean there's DNA of the Nephilim somewhere in humans today?
I don't know about humans, but our work on the Kandahar Giant and Steve Quayle's work on the Kandahar Giant prove that something is going on here. There's a bas relief which I have in my new studio. I blew it up, and it shows Egyptians fighting this huge giant, which is probably at least 10 feet tall. And there's just a bunch of dead Egyptians at this guy's feet. One of them is holding a spear. He's leaning back, trying to kill the thing, and the giant is just like towering over him. Look, this is a reality. This has been here. But because of a Darwinian paradigm, which insists that there is no supernatural, all this has been deliberately obfuscated from the public. And so the new series, On the Trail of the Nephilim, the first installment of that, Mound Builders, Mysterious Mound Builders, I mean, we really drill into it. And the second installment, which I'm editing now, it goes even deeper into the embedded mathematics, which are there in the mound, and there's nowhere that stuff can be there, but it's there.
How many mounds are there worldwide? What do you think?
Thousands. 10,000 alone in Ohio. 10,000 mounds in Ohio. And then you start going down to Mississippi. And thank God we have Squire and Davis in the mid, 19th century went out and began to survey these mountains, and that's why we have a record of many of them. And when we start looking at them, I remember when I was in Ohio and I went to the Great Circle Mountains for the first time, and I just sat there with my jaw on the ground going, wait a minute, what am I looking, what is this? Why get up on a Monday morning and build something like this? But, you know, as we delve into in the film, some of these sites, George, can only be appreciated from the air.
That's
the only way you can see
it. Like Nazca in Peru, same kind of thing.
Same kind of thing. The Serpent Mountain in near Peebles, Ohio. I've been there three different times. We filmed there a bunch of times. We went with Fritz Zimmerman and filmed there, and we were there at the spring equinox. And we flew the drone. I flew my drone way up and got great shots of it. But when you're there, you can't really, you don't know what you're looking at. And they even erected a 2.5-story lookout tower, observation tower. And you climb to the top of that, you kind of look out, yeah, you can kind of see it, but you really can't appreciate it.
No.
You get the drone up a couple hundred feet.
It looks like a snake.
It pops out.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Looks like a huge snake all over the place.
It's an undulating serpent. And it's also tied into the lunar precession, 18.5-year lunar cycle, the solstices, the equinox. And with all due respect, Native Americans knew about some of these things, but they didn't travel on this thing. And this is what I mean by the managed agenda. When you go there now, there's signage saying that the Shawnee built it. Chief Joseph comes on the record, and he gives me the link back to the chief of the Shawnee, who states unequivocally that while the Shawnee respected the Serpent Mound and could have sort of like was a caretaker of it,
mm-hmm.
in no way did they build it. So who are we going to believe?
Right.
You know,
now, in the
old tradition,
the official narrative for these mounds says that they're burial grounds. What do you think?
Some of them are. Many of them are not. The Great Circle Mound, for instance.
I mean, are there Native American bones and skeletons in these things?
Some of them are. Again, Native Americans would go in and sometimes use the mounds for burials. So we know that that happened. But when you go back into the record and you start reading some of what was coming out of the mounds, copper armor, six fingers, some of these things were 9, 10, 12 feet tall. They were huge, red hair. All this stuff was being reported, and then the Smithsonian would come in, get the evidence, and then it would just kind of disappear. So when you talk to people about it, talk to archaeologists, talk to docents, they look at you and they laugh because they've come up through a system which goes against all of this. So they're just parroting what they learned in school. But when you ask them, well, has anyone actually taken a hoe, a flint hoe, and gone out and see just how long it takes to dig a basket of earth? How long would it take? 25 million single buckets to build Poverty Point, which is smaller than Cahokia. Poverty Point.
Unless you have 25 million people doing it.
Well, there you go.
Which isn't going to happen.
Maybe 3 million people. These are hunter-gatherers. And not only that, in Ohio, George, you know, you only got about 7 months out of the year where you can dig.
They probably had 200 people tops working on these projects, I would guess. They didn't have a lot of people.
Yeah, they don't. And this is, when you really start drilling into it, it really becomes problematic. And in the second film, we talk about the mathematics that are embedded in these sites and the fact that many of them are in an 18.5-year lunar cycle. And I'll just tip my hand a little bit. We hired a surveyor to go into the Great Circle Mound in Ohio. This thing's about 1,200 feet in diameter. And there's a moat in the inside. That's why it's a hinge. This moat is about 6 to 8 feet deep. It's, I would say, closer to 8. So we had the surveyor, Todd Willis, go in. We use equipment. We wanted to find out how level the interior of the moat was. He said, and he says it on the record, it's almost dead level, between 6 inches and a foot. And that's within, you know, plus or minus because of the basically the dirt for thousands of years and sediment and everything else were piling up at the inside of this thing. He was taken aback. And so I asked him, I said, how would you do this in antiquity? And again, we've got another level plaza. Some guy wrote me at the break, all you have to do is flood it with water. Well, how do you flood a 40-acre parcel with water? I mean, where's the manpower to do that?
And where's the water coming from?
Exactly. Where's the water coming from? So, you know, when you start looking at this, the whole thing begins just to collapse. How did they do this? And, you know, Willis comes on the record as a surveyor, as an engineer, and he's looking at this, and he's puzzled by what he sees. He's never had to do this with these mounds. He's kind of scratching his head going, how did they do this? So it's very enigmatic, and I think that there's a hidden history. And what's amazing is that Native Americans, when asked, when the early white settlers came into these places, they were asked, who built the mounds? And they stated, we don't know. They were built. They were here when we got here.
Were they landmarks, LA? What do you think they are?
I think they're sites. Well, let me back up. The Serpent Mound, for instance, you can only see it from the air.
Right.
And the serpent is in the act of swallowing an egg. And I've talked about this on your show before. But that hails back to the Genesis 3:15 narrative. No one has ever put that together. We put it together in the film. It's like, who is the prince of the power of the air? Why is the serpent trying to devour this egg? Because it's the seed of the woman. And this is in your face, Genesis 3:15, screaming at you from near Peebles, Ohio, thousands of years old, which you can only see from the air. Who is the prince of the power of the air? The head of the fallen angels. So this stuff is like everywhere, George. It's all over the Americas, but it really follows the Mississippi down into the Gulf.
Are they messages for us left behind?
Well, I mean, the 18-and-a-half-year lunar cycle, some of these things are incredibly deliberate. We know that human sacrifice was practiced at these sites. We know that some of these sites are highly charged. Some of these mounds are highly charged. What I mean by that, ritualistic sacrifice was done there. Blood was spilled on these sites ritualistically. So are they gateways? Are they portals? That's conjecture on my part. I would say yes, they are. I would say the Great Circle Mound, for instance, when that was working, let's say, thousands of years ago, and that moat, that interior of that henge was filled with water, and the serpent mound, the two serpent heads at the entrance were still intact. They're no longer there, but they were intact, and there were no trees because the whole thing was a level plaza, and on top of the Eagle Mound, that's when the sacrifices would be done. That place was charged, and as Fritz Zimmerman, who's just an incredible researcher and author, and he appears throughout these films, Fritz said perhaps the water was to keep something in rather than let it out. So we've had, experiences there ourselves, which are not of the good kind, let's say.
Why is it so controversial, L.A.? Why do they seem to fight back and forth over this?
Because it points to the evidence of a supernatural worldview. And we all know that the prevailing paradigm in both the scientific community and in academia is
deny,
and it's Darwinism. Darwin runs the planet. You can go down the Peru and you can see the Darwinian theory, you know, chimpanzee just standing up and becoming modern human beings. It's just a bunch of hooey. No one knows how we got here, where we are in this universe, or what if there's life outside Earth, and how, you know, who we are, where we are, how we got here. Nobody has a clue.
Scientists just told us today that they have found 300,000 more galaxies with millions of stars in each galaxy. My God, the odds of planetary life out there in the universe has to be astronomical.
True, unless we're in a holographic universe, and then that whole theory just collapses of its own weight. And I think we are in some kind of holographic matrix type.
Explain that in the minutes we have before the top of the hour.
Okay, the deal is this. When these entities come in, and you know this, when the grays show up in your bedroom, well, let's hope it doesn't happen to either one of us, but when they show up, they manipulate space, time, matter, and energy. And that defies our physics. And they do it with seemingly without blinking an eye, basically. You're levitated. You pass. If you're being abducted, you're levitated off the bed. You go to the window. The window is closed. You think to yourself, are they going to open the window? They don't open the window. You go through the window. And that defies our physics. But we see this repeated in the biblical prophetic narrative. When these good messengers show up, the good angels show up, they manipulate space, time, matter, and energy in ways that defy our physics. So this leads me to believe that we're in some kind of matrix, and that's why these entities can pop in and can pop out and do the things that they do.
LA, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about your work, and we'll also take phone calls. This is a great opportunity, folks, to talk to one of the best researchers of all time, L.A. Marzulli. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's lamarzulli.net. No need to spell it, because just go to coasttocoastam.com and you'll get the link right there. One of his books, Days of Chaos. He's also got some DVDs out, too.